Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Well, there is a Living Cities initiative that was just announced. It has a philanthropic collaborative, a bunch of generous people who've announced they'll give $80 million in grants, loans, and investments, and they're going to split that $80 million among five cities. The cities are Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, Newark, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. But $80 million divided among five cities is really not a lot of money. That's about $15 million apiece. And the money is coming from the private sector, not the public. And we want to ask about exactly how this approach will work and how it works into what we know about urban renewal. And joining us now is an expert on that topic, Thomas Agru, history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So certainly we've come a long way since urban renewal meant the city going in and just laying waste to an entire neighborhood and building a mall or a freeway on top of it, right?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Urban renewal was ambitious but often devastating to the neighborhoods that it laid waste to, especially to African-American business districts that were leveled for highways and for civic center projects and others. But the flip side is that urban renewal was ambitious, and it laid the infrastructure for what are now some of the most important growth sectors in American cities, namely hospitals and higher education, which are absolutely critical to the economies of all the cities that Living Cities is funding.
All right. Well, $15 million didn't sound like a lot to us. We went and asked a couple people to be able to tell us what $15 million could possibly pay for. On the line with us, India Pierce Lee, a program director for Neighborhoods, Housing, and Community Development in Cleveland, Ohio. And let me start with you, India. Can you tell me a specific project that the $15 million could buy in Cleveland that would help?
Yes. The $15 million from Living Cities will actually assist us in continuing work that we launched in 2009, what is called the Evergreen Cooperatives, which is a community wealth building strategy to create wealth in the communities. And this will help low-income residents in this area not only get good-paying jobs but become worker owners. And so this will help us to leverage dollars and resources from the city of Cleveland, banks, and others to create more cooperatives. And one exciting one that will launch next year is Green City Growers. This will be the city of Cleveland has helped us acquire a 10-acre site, and it will be the largest urban food production greenhouse in the country. It will produce about 5 million heads of hydroponic leafy green lettuce in a year and 300,000 pounds of basil and herbs, but it will employ about 35 to 42 residents from this area, which encompasses seven neighborhoods of 43,000 people with incomes of less than 18,000.
And what's the price tag on it, India?
Price tag is about $18 million.
Okay, that is India Pierce Lee, Program Director for Neighborhoods, Housing, and Community Development in Cleveland, Ohio. And Joe McNeely is with us, Executive Director of the Central Baltimore Partnership. Joe, is there a specific partnership or project that this money could pay for?
I'd like to give you an example, but I think we need to think of the $15 million as not buying anything, but stimulating a larger investment. In Baltimore, about $12 million of that $15 million is capital that has to be lent to projects that have to stand on their own. So we expect that becomes the catalyst of $150 to $200 million of project. For example, we're endorsing the work of private owners to create a series of small arts venues in an old market that's at the center of stimulating our commercial area. And this is not a project that normally conventional lending would endorse. It's a partial rehab, one venue at a time. It's startups that provide local flavor. But when complete, then is able to be refinanced in a conventional way and lead on to other projects. So you see a ripple effect.
Right. What you're saying is you can't entirely put a price tag on that. That's Joe McNeely, Executive Director of the Central Baltimore Partnership. Let me get back to you, Thomas Agru, a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Is that correct that you can have projects that cost as little as $1 million, $2 million that end up having a ripple effect that can actually change something, a community or a neighborhood in a city?
Well, absolutely. Money leverage can lead to further investment in a neighborhood or a community, and good community development organizations are expert at making their rehab projects or redevelopment projects or job creation projects magnets for more. But we're still talking about a very, very small scale in the big scheme of the economies of Baltimore or Cleveland. They're doing it intelligently. They're looking to create jobs and to spur future development. But compared to even the modest investments of 40 or 50 years ago, these public-private ventures are pretty small.
You know, Professor Sugrue, one of the most famous—I mean, there is a scale question here, and I think we have a twisted set of priorities when it comes to cities. One of those famous lines in the famous Harper's Index, I don't know if you remember back in the 80s, a single episode of Miami Vice was $1.5 million, whereas the budget for the Miami Vice Squad for the entire year of 1984 was less than $1.2 million. I mean, that just sort of says it all right there. The federal government used to be a much bigger benefactor of the cities. What happened?
Well, and that's the critical question. And the answer is the growing political clout of suburban and exurban areas and the steady withdrawal of federal funding from the public sector across the board. I mean, in 1980, cities got about 12% of their budget from federal funds. By 1990, it was down to 3%. And we've been reeling with the consequences of that loss. And we've left it to non-for-profits and philanthropies that have the will and often really interesting and innovative ideas, but not always the capacity to deal with the long-term effects of that gutting of federal support.
What were the long-term effects of removing funding from the cities? I mean, did that then create a rise of the suburbs? They benefited disproportionately?
Well, a lot of the priority in terms of federal funding has gone to things like, say, highway construction, which still gets an enormous amount of federal funds, but channels people and dollars and investment further and further outward from the city centers that that Joe and India are working to rehabilitate, and that's just one example.
Well, I mean, so what would you recommend? Would it require the kind of hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent in some of the urban renewals projects of decades before?
Well, in the ideal world, yes, but we'd have to work with the constraints that we have, and even with an administration more committed to urban redevelopment than we've had in a very long time, it's still, for political reasons and for fiscal reasons, federal support for cities is still very, very far from the top of the list of priorities. So it does require imaginative, if small-scale, efforts to try to take the resources that are there, like Living Cities is doing.
Thomas Sugrue, history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks so much for joining us. We are looking for responses from you. What would be the first problem you would fix in your city if somebody gave you a big old grant? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE.
A listener in Boston says, I'd buy the abandoned factory property in the middle of our town, clean up the hazardous waste, and build a youth center and playground. Meanwhile, from Denver, a listener says, I'd spend it on available safe housing for single parents in transition. Denver is a philanthropic city, but the resources available not abundant this year. And a listener in Detroit says, Detroit needs better schools and to get all of its vacant buildings demolished. Keep the conversation going. Make a to-do list for the city in your neighborhood. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.